This podcast is brought to you by the Extension and Communication for the Australian Cherry Industry Project, funded by Hort Innovation using the Cherry Research and Development Levy and funds from the Australian Government. For more information, please visit horticulture.com.au. Welcome to the Cherry Picked podcast, the podcast that brings you the sweetest insights, tips, and stories from the world of cherry growing, packing, and consuming. I'm your host, Jess, and I'm here to connect with growers, researchers, and enthusiasts to share the wisdom, experience, and innovations that make cherry growing a rewarding experience. Whether you're tending to a backyard tree or managing hectares of orchard, this podcast is your go-to resource for everything cherry related. So let's get into it. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the Cherry Picked podcast. It is heating up here in New South Wales, where I'm recording today. It's 35 here in Orange, which for us temperate fruit people is scorching. So I hope all those cherry growers who have finished harvest and are currently putting their feet up, make sure you're keeping that water up to your trees because they would be absolutely sweating at the moment. Today, I'm really excited to be talking to Zen Kignos about cherry nutrition. I met Zen a few weeks ago and had to have him on the podcast after we chatted about the fate of some of the nutrients in the tree. So let's start by getting to know you, Zen. What's your background, role, and how do you fit into the cherry industry?
Thanks, Jess. My background is predominantly in two disciplines. It's in zoology and agriculture. So I started off as a zoologist, migrated into entomology, pest management, how to use beneficial insects to mitigate pest issues without using hard chemistry. And then I went into crop science and plant physiology. So that was always an interest. Even as a zoologist, the plant side of things was fascinating and everything's interlinked anyway. So you delve into one of these disciplines far enough, you'll end up in another discipline. So I was working with plants as I was working with animals and then it all kind of merged into one. And now I find myself really focusing on Australian agriculture and horticulture and on certain issues, national issues that growers are trying to deal with. So that's where I'm at the moment. My role in the company is a crop science technologist. Mm-hmm. So the company is ProDOS. We specialize in kind of non-conventional solutions to agronomic problems, whether that's using different strategies, different technologies, different products, fertilizers and things like that, biostimulants. Mm-hmm. And my role really is to identify crop issues with growers that they're struggling to fix and fixing them with our bag of tools, which might be in-house tools, things that we supply, or out-of-house. We'll source stuff from other companies as well if they've got something that we can use. That's really where I come from and where we're headed. So we're kind of going into this year, I mean, in particular, we've got an in-year year, so it's going to be hot and dry is what they predict. So stress, plant stress is going to be a big one for us to work on, particularly drought stress, high UV, maybe salinity, which is very similar to drought as the plant runs out of water, gets high in salt. So they'll be kind of this year's flagship issues we'll be working on. We already have some really good strategies to mitigate the damage of these things. And then it's just the standard stuff, really. How do we get more calcium into mature fruit and veg? Or how do we reduce our input costs, particularly with things like nitrogen? Can we reduce nitrogen and maintain yield, maintain quality? These are the questions we're working on. And we work with different companies. We work with government-funded groups. We work with grower groups and co-ops. So we're not alone on this. We kind of work collaboratively with many different groups to try and fix these issues.
Yeah. And thinking about cherry nutrition specifically, because I know you've got a wealth of knowledge and like you've just mentioned, you work with a lot of different groups and have seen a lot of different crops and their different nutrition requirements. But what are some of the key nutrition elements that we need to think about when we're thinking cherries? And what are some of the ways that we can get these into the plant?
So with cherries, very similar to apples, let's say. Cherries are like a very finicky apple in the way you do it.
Don't we know that?
So now the main nutrients that a plant needs, you know, everyone and their dog knows that. And it's really about looking at how we're using certain nutrients and how we can use them better. So now you have to take this with a pinch of salt, because we can only use what's available to us. So it's all well and good knowing, okay, this form is more available to the plant or whatever, but if it's not available to us as farmers to use, then it's completely irrelevant. So we have to look at what's available and then from that pot find the products and the technologies that are most efficient and that work the best. So a lot of people get caught up with quantity. Everything's about quantity. So, okay, the plant looks hungry, we need to put more of this on, for example. Or it's if you do a sap test or a leaf test or even a soil test and you're deficient in something, it's about putting more on. And that's kind of the standard agronomic practice these days on how to fix certain issues in the crop. But what you'll find is when you delve into why there's deficiency or why something is lacking, it's usually a physiological process that we're not quite getting right, or the plant might be quite stressed and it's using up those nutrients, or it's not getting as much nutrients as it should be. So it's really kind of playing detective and finding out what's going on. And then instead of just applying more of the stuff that we think is needed, it's about applying it at certain key timings where the plant can use it. And it's applying it in a form that might be more efficient for the plant to intake, particularly true for calcium, nitrogen, and a few others as well. It's timing is critical, and the form in which it's in is also very, very important. So for a lot of growers and agronomists, it's getting those analyses that they do to find where the balance is lacking, and then really kind of understanding that nutrient in particular, why it's not going in when it should be. Or, you know, we're putting huge amounts on, for example, but a fraction is going in. And why is that? Is it a temperature thing? Is it a location of where we're applying it? Is it a certain stage of the crop growth? Is the crop under a great amount of stress and that's why it's not going in? There's a lot of different factors there that we got to work out what it is, and then we can fix it. And a lot of the times what you'll find is we're using a hell of a lot more than we need. Even when the crop is deficient in whatever it is we're trying to fix, calcium being a great example, most people think nitrogen is the big wasteful nutrient. And it is. Nitrogen is hugely wasteful. But actually, calcium is potentially more wasteful for most people. They're actually applying so much more calcium than they need. And it's just because of the way the plant physiology works, that calcium follows water. So the calcium goes from the roots up, and it doesn't go from the leaf down. So people who are growing, for example, potatoes, and they're spraying calcium on their leaves, it's a complete waste of time, because it cannot physiologically go down into the tubers. It only goes up and out. So just understanding little things like that and how these nutrients work can really help people use them better and get a better output for the crop and use a lot less. And calcium is a really interesting one. It's actually a fascinating nutrient, and what the plant does with it and how important it is. For me, it is a major nutrient. I don't care what anyone says.
I think most of the growers would agree as well. I mean, everyone's always putting on calcium all the time.
Yeah.
When you're talking about timings and it's working with your agronomist, where would growers find this information to know about the correct timings to apply these nutrients such as calcium or nitrogen? I know there's been a little bit of work on nitrogen in cherries coming out of the University of Tasmania, but I don't think anyone's really touched calcium with a 10-foot pole. Mm. So where do they get their information from?
So most growers who've been growing for a while, they know through experience when it's working, when it's not. And they kind of just go off trial and error over the years of, okay, we've applied calcium now, we haven't really had a good result. And then they apply it another time, and, oh, actually, this is showing a lot better results. So just generally through trial and error of their practice, they get a feel for when the best timing is. But for fruiting sorry, for flowering fruiting trees, flowering is the best timing. So the way calcium works is we're trying to get the calcium from the xylem or from the water within the plant into the cell structure, into the cell itself of the fruit, for example. Mm. Now, how does calcium go from water through the membrane into the cell? It has to have auxin hormone within the cell. And it goes through polar auxin transport. That's the membrane transfer. So the plant basically uses auxin, the hormone, as a currency to swap for calcium. So it spits out auxin from the cell and it pulls in calcium through the membrane. So where do we get auxin from? Where do we get this currency from to allow the plant to take in calcium? And the answer is during cell division. When the plant is flowering, there's a lot of cell division happening. And that cell division is generating auxin and gives the plant a lot of currency it needs to take in calcium. So when you hear about, you know, people advise growers when to apply calcium, oh, well, flowering is a good time. And that's the reason why it is a good time, because we have the auxin needed to take in calcium during the flowering. And up to about pea-sized fruit, we have some very good cell division and we have a lot of auxin being generated. And it genuinely isn't that difficult to get calcium in at that stage. Now, we're talking most forms of calcium in most products. You don't need anything special, really, to get calcium in during that time, because there's a lot of auxin being generated and a lot of currency for the plant to take in calcium. But as soon as that fruit goes from pea-sized onwards and starts to mature and get bigger, the auxin available within the fruit starts to dilute and get used up. So the bigger the fruit gets, the less auxin is available and the less calcium can get in. That's why during, you know, late into the maturity of the fruit, close to harvest, it's very, very difficult to get calcium in. And we're talking all fruit and vegetables. We're not just talking cherries here. We're talking apples, mangoes, avocados, you name it. The bigger something gets, the harder calcium is to get in. So that's what we focus on is, okay, well, if we're running out of auxin after that pea-sized fruit stage, where can we get more? Or where can we get something that works in a similar way? And we use something that does that. It stimulates auxin. It's not a hormone. And the plant can use it to take in calcium at any stage of development because it can be used in the same way. So that's just one example of something we do that really can help on things like shelf life, cracking in cherries, and any kind of physiological disorders that come about with calcium. In apples, it's bitter pit. In tomatoes, it's blossom end rot. In carrots, it's cavity spot. There's a lot of physiological disorders that are caused by poor calcium. So focusing on the timing of when to apply calcium is very important. And also any products out there that can help facilitate that absorption of calcium, that's key. With calcium, it's not about quantity.
No.
People need to get their head around that. It's not about quantity. If you've got a calcium issue, the odds are you're actually using already far more than you need. The problem is it's either getting lost. So if the plant is stressed, it's actively using calcium. So it's actively being lost, or it's not getting in. Maybe there's not enough water flow, so there's not enough calcium. If the plant is stressed again, it's taking up less water and therefore less calcium. Or it might be using it to defend itself, uses calcium to start the process to make antioxidants. So we have a lot of areas where calcium is being lost.
And
the part of the plant that is predominantly supplied with calcium is the leaf. So because calcium follows water, the leaves are respiring the most over the fruit. So the water follows respiration and is preferentially deposited in the leaf. So because calcium follows water and water follows respiration, we get a lot of calcium buildup in the leaves. And when we do a leaf test, it can be very good calcium. When we do a soil test, it can be very good calcium.
It's not showing up in the fruit.
And it's really if you want to test for calcium, you test at the fruit because that's where we
get.
So we're doing some work with apples at the moment, and you know they're testing the leaf and it's fantastic, and they're testing the apple and it's no good. But and then when they apply a calcium product, they're testing the leaves. And it just doesn't make sense. That's not where we're looking for the calcium. That's not where we need the calcium. So there's no point testing for it there. It's usually quite easy to get calcium into the actual crop itself, the actual plant and the leaves. It's very, very difficult to get it into mature fruit.
So back in the fruit.
Yeah, that has to be the focus for growers and not to fixate on quantity. If we've got a calcium disorder or you've got a calcium deficiency, we need more calcium. Well, that's not going to fix the problem in the majority of situations. It's about applying it at the correct timings and also using products that can actually get it in at any stage of maturity.
So just thinking about applying calcium then, and I know a lot of growers that use foliar applied calcium, and just discussing what you were touching on just then, what are your thoughts on foliar application of calcium then? Is it a bit of a waste of time after the flowering, or is it still worth growers' while? What's your
definitely
thoughts on
that? Definitely worthwhile, my thoughts are we've seen it work a lot, and so we have first-hand experience of it working, which is one thing. It's always good to see it for your own eyes, you know, proof's in the pudding. But again, what you're doing with a foliar application of anything is you're bypassing the limitations of the roots.
Yep.
And when I say limitations, what I mean is if a plant is stressed, let's say you have an orchard of cherries and it's a particularly overcast day and it's low light levels and low temperature, and then the next day the sun comes out and it's quite hot, that's a stress event. And the crop might not have time to adapt to that difference in temperature or light levels, UV levels, and it gets stressed. And I mean, this happens all the time in orchards. It might, you know, not that's one example of an abiotic stress, but and what happens is they might take up less water when they're stressed, and therefore they're taking up less nutrients like calcium or other nutrients. Or there might be pH or temperature variance in the soil which limit certain nutrient uptake in the roots or slow it down. Or there might just be deficiency in the soil and not have enough there, even through the irrigation of what you need. So by spraying something on the leaves, what you're doing is you're bypassing all of that, and you're applying what you need where you need it, which is generally onto the fruit itself. And because, let's go back to calcium again, because it's sent to the leaves, it's predominantly sent to the leaf because the water's going there, it's not going to the fruit. So when we're doing a foliar spray, we are directly applying it to the fruit, and it makes it easier for it to get absorbed into the fruit, especially if it's a very efficient product. So, yeah, foliar is really where the industry is going. We've seen it over the last 3-4 years. A lot of growers now are moving to foliar applications, growers who never used foliar before. They only used to use insecticides or fungicides, things like that. But nutritional foliar sprays are becoming more and more popular. And now we have things like drones that can do the applications for us as well. We don't have to rely on tractors or costly aeroplanes. So it's becoming easier, and there are more products becoming available which can be applied foliar.
Yep. Yeah. And touching on, you know, drones and that whole new area of nutrition application, are there any innovative tools or techniques that have proven effective in optimizing cherry nutrition that you know of or that you've used in your work previously or into the future?
Well, yeah, drones are a really interesting one. So I used to do a lot of work on drones for releasing beneficial insects. With a company called Aerobugs. I think they might have actually been one of the first companies in the world to do that.
Cool.
They're really out there. This was, you know, 10 odd years ago.
Yeah, wow, that was a bit out there.
but it worked fantastically well because you get that application. You get that really nice application that helps improve what you're trying to achieve. And also it's not that costly because it's one guy, usually with one drone, who can do quite a large amount of area in a very short space of time. You're not paying for fuel, you're not paying for, you know, an aeroplane or a helicopter or anything like that, or even a tractor, which has its limitations in bad weather to get over the wet ground. So drones will be, I think, continue to be important in agriculture here in Australia. We are a little bit behind the times when it comes to that kind of stuff. When you go to America or Europe, you know, they're all over it. They have a lot of companies that specialize in this and have gone a long way. But we'll get there, and I think it will be a real good tool for orchard growers is to get drones in and out and get a good application over the crop where they might not before. Biology too, working on bacterias like Bacillus subtilis bacterias. We're doing a lot of work on that. We're doing work on mycorrhizal fungi, trichoderma, a lot of different biologies that are natural in the soil, which we can learn from and kind of replicate what they can do. And now a lot of products are coming out there onto the market that are biological, that we can apply into the soil and improve the root system. We can mitigate pathogens by using them too. They protect the roots. They're very good for soil structure. So we're actually improving soil by using them. Most of them are completely organic and natural. So there's no withholding. There's no detriment to use them. Yeah. It's more the merrier a lot of the time.
Yeah.
So one I use often is a Bacillus bacteria, which has a huge range of pathogen suppression. We can suppress Fusarium and Phytophthora and different things like that by having it in big numbers on the root zone. But it also helps with nutrient availability. And it's kind of a thing that's not mentioned very is how this biology can unlock non-plant available nutrients in the soil and make it plant available. So Bacillus, for example, can have a cellular, can break down cellular matter. So anything in the soil that's not directly plant available, the bacteria can compost over time and turn it plant available. And it really, you know, improves that nutrient availability at the same time as improving the roots. So bacteria like that actively boost root systems. So we've documented it on many, many different crops. We're in broadacre veggies, in orchards, in hydroponics, protected cropping. We've shown that just by incorporating a very small amount of something like this can quite drastically improve a root system of a plant compared to a control. And it's an ongoing thing too. These are living things that live on the roots that continually benefit the soil and the plants ongoing. Yep. It's not a synthetic product that we apply and then within a week it's disappeared and we've got to reapply. This is something that is multiplying, living on the roots in harmony with the roots, synergistically. And that's where I see really us going as an industry over the next very, very short period of time, year or two, before we've got a big boom in that kind of biological products, particularly in the fungal space. I mean, for example, Bacillus bacteria has been around for a very long time. It's one of the oldest researched bacteria for agriculture. But things like mycorrhizal fungi, we haven't had any products like that in Australia, certainly not many at all. So that's the space now that we're looking into and working on is what works in synergy with each other, because we don't want to add something, then add something out later that competes against it. It's counterproductive. So what works in synergy with each other? What works for each crop, variety within the crop, varietal changes? So these are things that is never ending. We're continuously working on this and helping growers make better decisions on what they should use and in conjunction with each other.
Yeah, and I don't know, this space I can really nerd out in this soil ecosystem and the microbes in the soil, because I absolutely love this area of work. And it's often something that has been a little, like you said, a little bit out of reach for Australian horticulture, but now is becoming more and more important as people start to understand the impact of some of our practices on the soil and how much of an influence that has on the tree. Even just increasing the root system, I mean, the opportunities to decrease the amount of inputs that you're putting in is quite astronomical, and that's something that I think the cherry industry would be, you know, well positioned, because we are a perennial horticulture system. We're not roughing up the soil all the time. We could build these ecosystems quite easily. Is there, once you start to get the microbes and your biologicals, you know, like you said, built up, how would growers then protect these systems? Is it an ongoing cost to then keep up with this biological space? Or is it, once you've kind of got your system, you can just be topping it up as we go along?
So I always say, if you want to do anything in the soil, don't touch it. The best thing you can do for soil is leave it alone. Because there's been millions and millions of years of evolution that's happened to create an ecosystem, a soil ecosystem that looks after itself, looks after plants. And one of the biggest problems we have is we have to feed plants, especially kind of big monocultures of plants. We've got to feed them, and feeding them means applying fertilizer into the soil. And usually we overdose, we apply huge amounts because the products we're using are inherently wasteful. So we have to overdo it because not a lot's getting in. And then it builds up over time in varying quantities of different nutrients, and it messes with the soil ecosystem and the structure of the soil. So, you know, the less input we can do, the better. And it's really us that's messing up the soil. It's not nature doing it. Nature's looking after itself. It's us. So if we want to look after soil, leave it alone. And that's kind of where they've gone in the broadacre space. The no-till movement is, actually tilling the soil exposes it to UV light, and it kills all of these beneficials in there, and it breaks up the structure, and it's not great at all. So the no-till movement has really shown that. Some of the growers that are getting results from no-till are surpassing what they used to do when they tilled, because their soil's improving. It's not being degraded.
When you're talking about UV exposure, and this might be a little bit of a loaded question, but a lot of our orchards, we implement what we call a bare herbicide strip down under the tree. And new research into keeping this area more protected through mulches or cover crops, or just having a mow and throw system where you're putting your grass clippings under the tree. Although it looks messy, is this a way that people can then protect that soil biology underneath the trees? And I know it's probably, you know, an endless question, but what are your thoughts on the bare herbicide strip?
for me, some of the best orchards I've ever seen are some of the messiest looking orchards I've ever seen.
Yeah.
So the more roots you have in your soil, I'm a big advocate for top crops, because the more roots you have in your soil, the healthier the soil. That's my philosophy. So a lot of these microbes and fungi, they thrive on root systems. Mm. And the actual structure of the soil as well is held together by these root systems of plants, even weeds, even plants you don't want there. If it has a root system going into the soil, it's probably doing something quite beneficial. So having a top crop there, or even grasses or anything there that's not bare soil, will be more beneficial than just bare soil, because it'd be less erosion, less compaction, improves the aggregate structure of the soil. And there's housing for the microbes that live there and the fungi. And so for me, the more plants that are there, the merrier. And it's just that kind of practical, how do you go about that without letting the weeds go out of control, you know? And so you've got to kind of play around with it as a grower with your orchard to see what works for you. But I've seen some really, really messy looking orchards that you just think, oh my God, there's stuff up to my knees all the way through. But they get bumper crops because the soil is fantastic. They're not degrading their soil. It's reducing compaction, like I mentioned, and it's promoting that biology within the soil. So I'm a big, big advocate for letting things grow and getting that root systems down into the soil to improve it.
And, I mean, it is a management thing too. Sometimes it's all well and good to have, you know, beautiful lush grass up to your knees, but I think a little bit more research, which looks like it's happening in out of Hort Innovation and a lot of other industries, are looking at cover crops and under tree management of mulches and things like that, to see how they would practically be implemented in our orchards. So I've just wanted to ask you, because I know we've been talking for a little bit now, but I'm really excited to hear about what you're excited for the next few years in regards to nutrient management in cherries, and what do the growers have to look forward to?
I think the main one for me, and the one I'm most excited about, is nitrogen. I think the world of nitrogen is so old school now in what we do, you know, we've been using these NPK fertilizers since World War II, and not much has changed since then. And really, it's a there's a big movement happening now in the nitrogen fertilizer space that I'm excited to be involved in, and it's about form. So it might not sound too glamorous, but just by changing the form of nitrogen we feed the plants, we can change where they allocate growth. And that's it's as simple as that. That's it in a nutshell. So there are three forms of nitrogen we can feed a plant. There's nitrate, which is NO3. There's ammonium, which is NH4. And there's amine, which is NH2. So most people, you know, they know nitrate. They use nitrates. They might use ammoniums or things like urea. Mm-hmm. But the problem has been these things, they, first of all, not much of it enters the crop when you apply it. So if you're applying your nitrogen fertilizer and you're getting 40% in, you're doing extremely well. And you're probably doing a lot better than most growers in the country. It's extremely wasteful, the majority of nitrogen fertilizer that we have available. Now, for strawberries, you might get 15 to 30% in if you're lucky. For cotton, you'll be getting about 33% in. So it varies depending on crop and depending on where you're growing and everything like that. But generalistically, you're not getting, I mean, nowhere near 50% in most cases. Yeah. So the first problem that we've had for a very long time is wasteful fertilizer. What we apply is just not going in. It's either volatilizing or it's leaching. And it's disappearing before the plant can take it in. So that's problem number one is quantity. We have to overload to compensate for the waste. So we're using, you know, three times more than we should be just because it's not all going in. And then the second problem we've had for a long time is that whatever we are applying, whether it's urea or organic nitrogen or ammonium, it's getting converted into nitrate predominantly before the plant can uptake it. So the plants are actually taking in nitrate a great deal. And we might even be feeding the plant pure nitrate anyway to add to that. So things like Bacter Simona or Nitrobacter, they are actively converting nitrogen from one form to another very, very quickly. And it ends up in the nitrate form. And when the plant takes it in as nitrate, it takes it up to the leaf for processing. And then we get a backlog in the leaf. We get a spike in auxin hormone. Mm-hmm. And that's what gives us a lot of leaf growth, a lot of vegetative growth. And that's not what growers are looking for the majority of the time. you know, 95% of all the growers I work with don't want leaf. Nope. They want fruit, or they want vegetables, or they want, you know, tubers, or, you know. So that's the problem number two, is the form that we're giving the crop is not what we need, because it's giving us an outcome that we don't want. So we've got to feed the plants, so we are, and then it's going in as a form that we don't want it to go in as, and causing an effect we don't want. We're getting vegetative growth. So to fix problem number one, which is waste, we've got to stabilize the nitrogen. We've got to make it so it doesn't volatilize or it doesn't leach. And then to fix problem number two, which is form, we have to also stabilize it in the form that we want it in. And that's an amine form is most ideal. So what happens with amines when we feed a plant is it doesn't take it to the leaf like nitrate. It takes it down to the roots and it processes it in root hairs. So the plant puts out more root hairs as sites of processing because it needs more sites of processing because it's got more amine than it had before. And when the plant puts out more root hairs and more roots, another hormone starts to spike called cytokinin. And that's the reproductive hormone of the plant. So we feed a plant amine, gets processed in the roots, cytokinin goes up, and it retilts the hormonal balance of the plant naturally to promote reproductive growth, roots, flowers, and fruits. So just by changing the form of nitrogen we're feeding the crop, we're actually reallocating where it's growing. We're changing the phenotype of the plant. And there's a lot of work now being done on this, on stabilized amine nitrogen. It's very exciting because we can use a fraction of what we used to use, and it's giving us a better outcome at the end of the day, which is better flower retention, better fruit set, more lateral branching, so we've got more fruits or vegetables, so more yield, and a better, bigger root system, which is supporting everything. So it's really exciting because we're now moving into a different era of nitrogen nutrition for crops.
Yeah.
That's very well researched and becoming even increasingly better researched in the literature to show, to back it up and show what it can do. So we've been playing around with that for about 2 years now in different crops, including cherries, and getting some really significant results.
Yeah.
That's a space that's really coming along is nitrogen and what different forms can actually do to the plant. We've only really had nitrate up till now.
And how exciting is that? And I know growers would just be, I don't know about the listeners, but my mind is blown. And I'm hoping that everyone's sitting there as stunned as I am and my previous conversation with Zen, because this could be absolutely, I want to say, life-changing for some people, as you mentioned, Zen, the three different facets of how this might improve your orchard business. And there's no doubt about it, and no one's naive enough to think that these regulations or that these requirements are not coming. We do a lot of export into markets that are quite environmentally conscious, and we just need to be on the front foot, like you said. So it is so important to start to think about these things, and when it's a win-win-win, you might as well have a bit of a look into it and start having your own research into these new forms of nitrogen. I know that some growers would still have a lot of questions, as I do, and I've said to Zen that there's so many different things that we didn't get to talk about today, but I would love to have him back on and maybe even do a bit of a webinar series, because he knows all things about plant stresses and different nutrients, including options for cherry cracking. So we'll have to have Zen back on. But if growers wanted to have a bit of a conversation with you or have a talk about their own orchard, where can they find you and where's the best place to start looking?
The best place would be just flick me through an email, I think. Zen at prodoz, prodoz.com.au. And yeah, we'll just have a conversation about what it is that you're working on and what it is you want to achieve and how we can get there. There may be things we can't help with, there may be things we can help with, but that's why we have the talk and see what we can do. And a lot of the times, already done it with other growers. So we're very confident in some things that we can achieve. Reducing plant stress is one, and that's a really important one. And I'd love to talk more at length with that at some point, Jess, about plant stress, because it's the number one reason for crop yield loss globally. It accounts for about 80% of global yield loss in agriculture. So not talking about stress is silly. We need to really talk about it, because it's not something people talk about often. They talk about deficiencies and different disorders, maybe biotic stresses like fungi or bacteria, diseases, but abiotic plant stress, like weather, heat, cold, salinity, acidity, these are really what is accounting for yield loss. And how we can mitigate the damage of that can really go a long way to improving someone's orchard and giving them more produce to sell.
And what I'll do is I'll pop Zen's email back down in the show notes, and I'll also include a bit of a link to his website. Zen, I know we'll have you back on again soon, but thank you so much for jumping on today and taking your time out of your busy schedule. And I'm really looking forward to being able to provide this to the growers and for them to listen about our conversation today.
Thanks, Jess. Appreciate it. Enjoyed it.
No worries. And see you all next week. Bye for now. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Cherry Picked podcast. If you like what you heard, please subscribe so you don't miss any episodes and refer us to a friend. If you have any feedback or guest suggestions, please get in touch via the contact information in the show notes. happy growing, and we will catch up in the next episode.